This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Zähneputzen am Morgen ist selbstverständlich. Warum nicht auch Sonnenschutz? 90% der Hautalterung entstehen durch Sonnenlicht. Das Beste, was du also für deine Haut tun kannst, täglicher UV-Schutz, auch an Tagen mit niedrigem UV-Index. Entdecke jetzt den Testsieger laut Stiftung Warentest. Die Eucerin Oil Control Gel Creme mit Lichtschutzfaktor 50+ macht täglichen Sonnenschutz ganz einfach. Sie ist ultraleicht, zieht schnell ein und mattiert langanhaltend. Mit dem Code SUN20 bekommst du jetzt 20% Rabatt auf alle Eucerin Sun Produkte bei shopapotheke.com. Nur bis zum 31. Juli.
Welcome to Lady Killers with me, Lucy Worsley, where true crime meets history with a twist from BBC Radio 4. I'm joined by a team of female detectives to investigate the ordinary lives and extraordinary crimes of some of the most astonishing murderesses of the 19th and 20th centuries. Today, we bring you a story that starts like a fairy tale. Can you imagine being swept off your feet by a handsome prince, showered with diamonds and clothes and perfume, welcomed aboard his private yacht, whisked away to his resplendent palace? But then you discover that the dream is in fact a bit of a nightmare. What might happen if things turn sour? And what might you do to escape?
Qu'est-ce que j'ai fait, mon cher?
A prince shot dead. Wife accused of murder at the Savoy.
Venez vite. Venez vite. J'ai tiré sur un lit. Je ne sais pas comment j'ai fait ça.
Servants heard his agonized shriek above the roar of the thunderstorm. His wife was found in a hysterical state in her bedroom close by, with bloodstains on her gown.
What have I done? I have been married 6 months and it has been torture.
A great mistake, possibly the greatest mistake a woman could make, was as a woman of the West in marrying an Oriental.
I'm Lucy Worsley. I'm taking a look, a feminist look actually, at deadly crimes committed by women from all walks of life. What kinds of worlds did these women live in? And would their stories play out differently today? This time, our killer is Marguerite Farmy, a French woman from Paris, who in 1922 embarks on a whirlwind romance with a wealthy Egyptian man called Ali Kamel Farmy Bey. Together, they tour some of Europe's most exclusive destinations, and they marry in Egypt just months later. Then, in the summer of 1923, Marguerite and Ali head to England for a holiday to enjoy the London season, staying, where else, at the Savoy, one of the capital's most glamorous hotels. To find out how the fairy tale came to a grisly end, I'm joined in the studio by two remarkable women. Neka Akadolu, a barrister, a KC, actually, with 20 years of experience. Neka, am I right that you specialise in serious and complicated crimes?
I do, mostly. I specialise in exclusively criminal law, and it encompasses mostly homicide cases, serious sexual offences and large-scale drug operations.
You say that with a little flicker of a smile on your face.
That's my daily diet, sex, drugs and murder.
Also joining me today is our very own in-house historian, Professor Rosalind Crone from the Open University. Hello, Ros.
Hello, Lucy.
Now, Ros, let's start with you. In pursuit of Marguerite and her story, we sent you to the Savoy Hotel itself in the West End of London. Very fancy.
Oh, well, I just had to grin and bear it, Lucy.
And what did you find out?
We found out that we actually needed to visit the building next door, an office block that in 1923 was part of the Savoy Hotel.
Let's listen in and hear what you discovered about Marguerite on her high-end holiday.
Here I am on the fourth floor of the Savoy Court. Now, at the moment, it's actually being renovated. So there's cords hanging from the ceiling. There's bits of the ceiling missing. There's quite a noisy air conditioner unit. But in 1923, this is where they had these amazing luxury suites for very wealthy guests. And if I just walk around here, this would have been the site of suite number 41, where Ali and Marguerite were staying.
I'm here with the Savoy archivist, Susan Scott. Hello, Susan.
Hello.
Susan, am I right in thinking that the Savoy is the only hotel in London with its own archivist?
I think I'm the only hotel archivist anywhere. I've never met another one anyway.
Oh, fantastic. Brilliant. OK, so we're in West London, which today, as you can see, looking out the window, is buzzing with tourists, much like it would have been in 1923. We have theatre land, restaurants, shops, new department stores in the 1920s, and the nightclubs, of course, in Soho. Susan, who was actually staying here in the 1920s?
People like Fred Astaire, Tallulah Bankhead, Cecil Beaton, Coco Chanel, Winston Churchill had an account at the Savoy the moment he was old enough to have an account, Noel Coward, Dame Nellie Melba, and the entire cast of the Ballet Russe when they came to England, which included a rather young Anna Pavlova.
So we've got celebrity here, we've got royalty, aristocracy, gentry, and we also have the world of showbiz.
Indeed. Everybody, all together.
Yeah, well, it's the 1920s.
Indeed.
Yeah.
The Savoy is the first purpose-built deluxe hotel. It was the place to go and see and be seen. And so if you were the least bit fashionable, you would want to go there.
I've brought with me some pictures from the newspapers of Marguerite and also her husband, Ali. I think this is quite an interesting one. Very 1920s, very of
the day. It's fabulous, isn't it? She looks a bit like a fashion plate.
Yeah, and we've got the side parting in the hair, the pearls, the drop waist. She looks like she's ready to go out dancing. Ali, on the other hand, I think he looks quite dashing, but gosh, he looks young.
He does, he looks like a boy here, doesn't he?
Yeah. Marguerite was in her early 30s, and he was only 22. They travel from Egypt via Paris to London, and I think this is where they are staying, right here in this building on this floor. Is that right?
Absolutely right. What the families were staying in was actually a suite, quite a large suite in actual fact. It's got several rooms and it's got its own private bathroom. Now, it does only have one bathroom, but even in the 1920s, that was still quite a luxury for an awful lot of people.
I think you've brought some photos as well.
I can't say it's exactly the same suite, but it gives you a sense of what it would have looked like.
Excellent.
A Savoy Apartments was built in 1904, and it is actually rather glorious when you look at some of these pictures. There's a living room here that's absolutely wonderful.
It is. I mean, all that detail on the ceilings and down the walls, the framing, much nicer than my architrave. And then the bedrooms. We've got two bedrooms, twin beds. And twin beds, of course,
well,
the height of luxury in the 1920s.
It is the 20s, yes, and no respectable married couple would possibly sleep in a double bed when you could have nice single beds like these.
Exactly, yeah.
The height of luxury indeed. But unfortunately, the farmies are in no mood to enjoy it. They check in on the 1st of July with an entourage of personal servants, a secretary, a valet, a maid or two. It's a hot, sticky summer. On the 9th of July, one of the worst storms in living memory breaks out in London. Marguerite and Ali argue all day long, everywhere they go, in the hotel dining room, then the theatre, over supper, and in the ballroom. A little after 1 in the morning, Marguerite goes upstairs to their suite.
L'orage était terrible. J'avais très peur et j'étais très tendue et très fatiguée. The storm was raging terribly. I was very much afraid and I was very nervous and very tired besides.
A little later, Ali follows her up. Then at 2:30 a.m., a hotel night porter is going along the corridor outside the farmie's suite. The couple are in the corridor having another full-blown argument. Their little dog is running about too. The porter wants to get on. He asks them to keep the noise down and walks on by.
When I got to the bottom of that corridor, I heard a slight whistle. I turned my head and saw Mr. Farmy bending and whistling and snapping his fingers to a puppy which was following me. It belonged to him.
But then, three shots ring out in quick succession. He rushes back to see Marguerite throwing a pistol to the ground and falling to her knees besides Ali. He's wearing a white jalaba and his slippers, and he's bleeding all over the floor. He's taken to Charing Cross Hospital where, within the hour, he dies. And who killed him? Well, it was obviously his wife, Marguerite.
J'avais perdu la tête. Je lui ai tiré. I lost my head. I shot him. What have I done? What can I do? I have been married 6 months and it has been torture. I have suffered terribly.
She's the first of our lady killers to use a gun, which was brought into the country illegally. And we have a witness who's seen it fall, practically smoking from her hand. Case closed, surely. But we wouldn't be here if there wasn't a bit more to it than that. Firstly, Necker, let's get your insight. How often does this situation occur? Wives killing their husbands?
Well, women who kill cases are quite rare. By illustration, in 20 years, I've only been involved in one case where a woman has stabbed her partner in the neck, and that was after years of abuse. But there's been research, fairly recent research, from the Centre for Women's Justice that revealed that in a 10-year period, there were only 108 cases where women had killed their partners, comparatively to about 840 cases where men had killed their partners. And of those 108 cases, about two-thirds of them were in a domestic setting where the women had been or had alleged that they'd suffered abuse at the hands of their partners.
That's a really striking statistic. So there's an absolutely tiny number of murders committed by a woman against her partner where abuse isn't involved.
Absolutely, yes.
This is very interesting, as Marguerite tells us that she has suffered terribly. Roz, I think we need to know a bit more about her. Can you tell us who this woman is, please?
Well, the police have to do some digging. The results of their investigation can be found in a file at the National Archives, and I brought along copies with me today. They discover that she was born as Marguerite Marie Alibert in Paris in 1890.
She's a very humble birth, her father being a cab driver and her mother a charwoman. What's she doing in a luxury hotel married to a prince?
Yeah, that's a good question.
I've just answered my own question. At an early age, she joined the ranks of high-class, fast women, having numerous lovers, particularly rich and titled men.
Exactly. Marguerite was a courtesan, essentially a sex worker with a very wealthy and international clientele, including, it's been claimed, the Prince of Wales, later Edward VIII. She had actually built up a pretty impressive income through gifts and allowances from previous clients, including one ex-husband, and all of this after a troubled early life. She had had an illegitimate child at age 16 and lived on the streets for 10 years. Mm. And then, in addition to all this work by the British police, Ali's family hired their own lawyer in Egypt. Now, he finds witnesses who claim that Marguerite had told them that as well as stabbing one of her earlier lovers seven times, she had planned to murder Ali all along, to murder him for his money.
Says he has nine cars, really?
Yeah, also a yacht, a palace on the banks of the Nile. And although he wasn't actually a prince, like the newspaper said, he had a title that was more akin to a knighthood for philanthropy. He was phenomenally rich.
She gave plainly to understand that at some time in the future she intended to kill him. Well, this is not looking good for Marguerite, is it?
Well, fortunately for Marguerite, at least, the director of public prosecutions at the time decided to ignore this evidence completely.
Ooh, do you think that's a sense of superiority, a colonial attitude at work there?
Quite possibly. It's worth remembering that Egypt was occupied by Great Britain until 1922, when it gained a kind of independence, although the British retained control over its foreign policy and, of course, the Suez Canal.
Well, the British public can't get enough of Marguerite's story. Her trial begins on the 10th of September 1923 at the Central Criminal Court. That's the Old Bailey, and it's a sensation. The courtroom is packed to the rafters. Amongst the spectators, lots of women, high society ladies, teenage shop assistants, and actually England's first two female barristers. Thanks to a change in the law in 1919, there are even two women on the jury. It's likely that a lot of these women will have read a so-called desert romance novel, or indeed many desert romance novels, which are hugely popular in the 1920s. Interracial marriages are fairly unusual and often condemned, but there's this huge market for stories about supposedly innocent Western women seduced by handsome men of Eastern heritage, who are usually portrayed as civilized on the surface and pleasantly barbaric underneath. As historian Lucy Bland points out, Marguerite and Ali's relationship must have seemed like a real-life desert romance leaping off the page, despite its decidedly unromantic conclusion. But let's get back to the Old Bailey, where the trial is getting started. That's Sir Percival Clarke for the prosecution. He has reason to be feeling quite confident. He can prove that the pistol was hard to fire. It took intent and some skill. And Marguerite had pulled the trigger three times. That wasn't a mistake or even self-defense. It was murder.
Mr. Farmy was shot while bending down playing with the dog. Can there be any doubt that what really happened was that the accused, angry, cross, quarreling, seized the pistol, which he knew was in working order, and fired it at her husband?
But for the defence, a legal legend. Sir Edward Marshall Hall, KC. He's known as the Great Defender. This was self-defence, he says. Marguerite didn't know that the gun was loaded. She was in fear of her life. In court, we have two completely different stories. The prosecution says that Ali was a quiet, retiring man. But the defence insists that he was cruel and violent, that he demanded slave-like obedience from his wife, that he dislocated her jaw, locked her up on his yacht, and repeatedly dared her to kill herself. On the second day of the trial, Marguerite herself takes the stand. She doesn't speak English, so the jury and the public hear her words in translation.
J'ai toujours espéré qu'il changerait. I had always hoped he would change. Every time I threatened to leave him, he cried and promised to alter. I passed from despair to hope, and from hope to despair.
Were you really frightened that your husband or someone in his employ would do you an injury?
Yes. He always said, if it is not I, it will be someone else.
Marguerite's barrister, Edward Marshall Hall, intimates that Ali was sexually depraved.
A beast whom the vilest words known cannot adequately describe.
He says that Ali forced unnatural sexual intercourse on his wife and that she had painful anal injuries to prove it. He says that she's a poor, wretched woman suffering the tortures of the damned. Now, Necca, this is where we need your expert translation of what's going on in this courtroom. Marguerite's barrister, Marshall Hall, he doesn't just state the facts, does he? He's a showman, would you say?
He certainly was, and obviously he had that title of the Great Defender. This is a man physically who was very commanding. He was sort of over 6 foot tall. He was quick-witted. He was a fantastic orator. And he was the sort of person who was a very effective jury advocate. But what he did during the course of this trial was, and it seems that the prosecution, you know, in a sense, let him, is he ignored all of the evidence that was harmful to his case. Marshall Hall decided to concentrate on other matters, such as how frail Marguerite was. You know, he presented Farmy as bestial, as this violent individual, whereas Marguerite was put forward as someone who was, she was quite diminutive in frame and someone who was quite tragic and helpless. That's the sort of direction he took the jury in, and it worked.
The prosecution gave him too easy a ride.
Absolutely, yes.
In a 2.5-hour closing statement, the Great Defender really lets loose.
Eastern men, as I have said, are courteous, civilized, and elegant. But underneath lies the Eastern temperament, and the Eastern idea of how a woman should be treated. Members of the jury, I want you to open the gates where the Western woman can go out. Not into the dark night of the desert, but back to her friends, who love her in spite of her weaknesses. You will open the gate and let this Western woman go back into the light of God's great Western sun.
Roz, that couldn't be clearer, really. West good, East bad.
Yes, Marshall Hall is making a direct reference to one of those wildly popular and overtly racist desert romances. It's a novel called Belladonna, published in 1909, but still instantly recognisable for the British public.
So, Necker, here we've got a man who's doing his job. He's using rhetoric to persuade a jury for things to go his way. But he's also using the racism that exists in society to do his job, isn't he? That couldn't happen today, right?
Well, not from counsel. But, you know, there are recent reports, as recent as last year, that concluded that there is racism within the criminal justice system and racism within the judiciary and racial bias. An example I can give you of a case that I was involved in, I was defending a Romanian national for a serious sexual offence. He spoke no English, and so he was using an interpreter. And during the course of the judge's summing up, the judge told us that the interpreter would not be able to translate for him because, in his words, she was speaking too loudly. And so this individual on trial for a serious offence was expected to be the only person in that courtroom, not knowing at all what was being said about him. You know, I had some robust submissions to make in response to that judge, who thankfully allowed the interpreter to interpret for him. It just goes to show that this person was so obviously being treated differently because of where he was from.
Nick, if you were Marguerite's defence today, what strategy would you use?
My strategy would be to run the defence of diminished responsibility. She would be assessed by a number of experts, psychiatrists, psychologists. Then that abuse could be shown to have affected her mental state to such an extent that her responsibility was diminished. So it reduces her culpability and it would lead to a conviction for manslaughter rather than murder. Because she did shoot
her husband. Yeah.
What I keep coming back to is that he was shot at close range to the head and further shots in his back by a woman who claimed not to be an accomplished markswoman. That is not guilty. That is not an acquittal. It's not a walkout, as we would say.
Mm.
There's well-publicised cases that Sally Challen, whose conviction was overturned in 2019, she pleaded guilty to manslaughter because it was accepted that she had been the victim of coercive and controlling behaviour by her now deceased husband. She killed him. She hit him multiple times with a hammer. And so in any other circumstances, that would be murder. But for the effect that his emotional abuse had on her.
But it's important to point out that Sally Challen spent quite a number of years in prison.
9 years. She tried to appeal once. That failed. And then there was a new offence created in 2015, coercive and controlling behaviour. And that's when people really started to understand that domestic abuse also encompasses emotional abuse, you know, including financial abuse, alienating a spouse from their family, from their friends.
But what about Marguerite in 1923? On the 15th of September, the jury takes just over an hour to find her not guilty, acquitted of all charges, free to go. There's rejoicing inside the courtroom. The verdict is nearly drowned out by the cheering. But what happens after a person found innocent leaves the dock? Marguerite takes a suite at the Prince's Hotel in Piccadilly to recover herself. She is now a celebrity. Back at the Savoy, Roz spoke to its archivist, Susan Scott, to find out what Marguerite did next.
There's no trace of Marguerite or the shooting here today, which at the time would have seemed incredible. Everyone wanted to read about her. Did they come here to the Savoy?
People probably did. As I understand it, for a long time afterwards, if you actually happened to be on the fourth floor, you could still see the bullet holes where she'd hit the door frame.
Wow, okay. Well, what we do know is that she sold her story to the press, to the Illustrated Sunday Herald. And here we go. Nightmare of My Trial by Marie Marguerite Farmy.
I can see there's a little extract down the bottom of her own handwriting. Whoever the journalist is, when they met her, they comment on the fact she's wearing a generous number of slender platinum rings, two of them decorated with large square stones. So she definitely had a taste for the money.
Yes, and of course, she even made an attempt to get hold of Arlie's money, the inheritance, by coming up with a fake pregnancy, which all just went wrong for her. But she was still a wealthy woman in her own right. She still had her own means. And she continued, she lived in Paris up until her 80s. When she died in 1971, living opposite the Ritz. So it kind of feels like we've come full circle, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Necker, what are your feelings at the end of all of this? We feel that justice wasn't done, don't we?
No, I don't believe justice was done in these particular circumstances. On the evidence that the prosecution had, which on the face of it was very strong evidence, this should have led to a conviction of some sort for either murder or manslaughter.
And yet it's not straightforward, is it? Because it's possible she was also the victim of abuse.
Absolutely, yes.
What do you think, Roz?
Yeah, looking at it in its historical context, there's a very real risk that this woman on trial will hang. And so I guess from my point of view, I still feel better about the fact that she walked free.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. There was no coercive and controlling behaviour in 1923.
No.
Well, perhaps life isn't as neat as we'd like it to be. I find this case so interesting because it's intersectional. It demonstrates perfectly how a person can be privileged in one way and disadvantaged in another. Marguerite was undoubtedly a killer, but quite possibly a victim as well. Ali, well, he may have been an abusive husband, but of course he was also a victim of homicide and of racism too. Thank you ever so much to Necker Akadolu KC, Professor Rosalind Crone, and Savoy archivist Susan Scott. Next time on Lady Killers, we're heading to Liverpool in the 1880s to meet Catherine Flanagan and Margaret Higgins, a pair of life insurance fraudsters known as the Black Widows. Lady Killers with Lucy Worsley was produced by Sarah Goodman, and the readers are Mina Ryan and Jonathan Keeble. Sound design is by Chris McLean, and the series producer is Julia Habel. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4.